Blog Talk Radio.
Come shine your light, open your heart, show us your gift that sets you apart. When you believe, then you can see that you are the star of your own destiny.
Hi, and welcome to the Honoring Hour. My name is Lynn, and I'm your host of the show. Today is September 21st, so here in North America, we are about to celebrate the fall equinox, which I hope that all of you will be enjoying as autumn in this area, my area specifically. I love the changing and the colors in the trees and just all the wonderful things that symbolizes for me. Before we get started with today's show, I just wanted to mention a couple of things that are upcoming. On October the 5th, we are going to have Stephen Victor here, and he's going to be talking to us about some of the changes that are happening on the planet and just some, how to get settled in and deal with things and not buy into all the mainstream BS. On the 19th, and I have to apologize, I am just confused with my dates these days. Yes, it is the 19th. We're going to have Jose Ruiz on the show, and he is going to be talking about the book that he has written with his father, The Fifth Agreement. So we hope that you all will join us then, and we're going to have a couple of meditations sprinkled in there, so just be sure to check out our website, www.thehonoringhour.com, for any of the upcoming information. For those of you who are loyal listeners and do check out our website, I do want to offer an apology. My computer went kaput sometime last month, and I am a bit behind on updating. So all the information's there. It's just the current shows that I normally try to move to the archives page are still going to be listed on the guest page and in there. But the rest of the information's all there, and it's accurate. They just aren't necessarily on the right pages. So that brings us to today's show, which I am super excited about. Last year, I was fortunate enough to have a wonderful author and person on the show, Jeff Brown, and he sent me an email saying, hey, I want to introduce you to a really fantastic person who's written an absolutely incredible book. So I jumped on that, and I contacted today's guest, and he's agreed to be on the show and talk with us about his book. His name is Philip Shepherd, and his book is New Self, New World, Recovering Our Senses in the 21st Century. So, Philip, welcome to the show today.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm glad to have you. Can you tell us a little bit about, because I don't know you personally. I've been reading your book, but I don't know you personally. Can you tell us a little bit about what you do and how you got to put out this book?
Yeah, I'll try to keep it short because, you know, the book, you know, you realize in retrospect, you look back on your life and you realize, okay, this thing has been in me for decades and decades. And it really began when I was a teenager. I was just acutely aware of being in fetters. You know, I was being bound by forces I didn't understand. And to find my freedom within that, I actually went through a period of, you know, kind of deep rage at the way in which my clarity was being compromised by forces I could only dimly begin to see. One of the things I was aware of is that my culture itself constitutes a sort of story about what it means to be human. And that story is expressed in our architecture, in our social hierarchies, in our language, in every aspect of the world we create around us. And I sort of understood that in order to gain the kind of clarity I so yearned for, I'd have to step outside of the culture. So I had been fortunate enough to, I've been an actor all my life, and I was fortunate enough to have learned a little bit about a form of classical theater in Japan called No Theater, and I'd seen a production of that in 1971 in Montreal, actually. It devastated me. I was overwhelmed by this consummate art form that at the same time violated every precept that I had been told was indispensable to the making of theater. So I actually went to England. I didn't have any money. I was 18. But I bought a bicycle and headed off on the bicycle, reasoning that if I kept pedaling and the bicycle was sort of aimed in the right direction, I'd eventually get to Japan. I did. I cycled through Europe and the Middle East and India and through Japan itself. And that experience lives with me to this day. I went through so many different understandings of what it means to be human, of what the human story is, of every culture has a different take on it, and so the book really arose out of my sort of undiminished desire to be free of the unseen fetters of my culture and which consistently mediate between us and reality. They're always getting in the way of the present that we inhabit, and in a nutshell, that's where the impetus of the book came from.
Well, I have to say, you know, in the book, you really cover a very wide variety of, in my opinion, you cover a wide variety of not so much topics, but of avenues to get to. To get your point across, it really reaches out to a lot of different cultures, a lot of different mindsets, way of believing. I think you've done a really beautiful job of pulling that in. And I have to say that when you first started describing, you know, that feeling of just kind of being fettered and you know, held in by other things, I was thinking, gosh, this man is describing my youth, you know. That's exactly how I felt and went about it differently than you did. You seem to have gone about it in a really interesting way. But one of the things I love about your book, Philip, is it really brings people what I call into their body. I think that is so incredibly important. So when people are reading your book, what do you... when they close that book, what is one thing you would love to see them walk away from saying, I got this from that book?
Well, it goes back, my hope goes back to the title, New Self, New World. The body, you know, that we take our culture's story as children, we accept it holus bolus, so that it becomes the normal of our reality, and we forget that we confuse reality and the story. We think the story is the reality, and so we heed the aspects of the story that interpret reality for us, and lose our capacity to connect with the present in all its living genius. And so, what the book does is it shows something that I don't know anyone else has talked about. It shows that our Neolithic forebears, now the Neolithic era was the one in which we discovered agriculture and built permanent settlements and domesticated animals, and you know, it was underway by about 6000 BC, but in that area we experienced the center of ourself in the belly, and you can see the book traces that out in the etymology of our language. And then it begins to shift, and the shift is actually precipitated by this new, it's like the most major paradigm shift we've undergone as a culture, because we went from a female-centered culture to a male-centered culture with the Neolithic Revolution. And that necessitated a change in how we live in our bodies. So we moved from an experiential center in our belly, which is associated with our sense of being, our sense of relationship. In fact, our word for navel turns up in Sanskrit to mean relationship, and it turns up in a host of ancient European languages to mean the hub of the wheel, that empty space at the center of the wheel around everything, around which everything revolves, which is you know, that's where the center of the self sat, by the navel, and all the sensations of the world revolved around that center. And it migrated by the time of Homer. It was in the chest. And you can also see that clearly in Egypt. In fact, when Egyptians prepared a body for mummification, they threw the brain on the trash heap. They took the internal organs and preserved them in jars, except for the heart, which they left in the body because they understood, they experienced the heart. They experienced their center of thinking at the heart, and knew, identified it as the mind, and knew that, you know, it would be needed in the afterlife. And it's not until Plato's day, in a book, Timaeus, that he wrote, you can see that, in fact, in Timaeus, he gives us the sort of prototypical experience that we take for granted today, which is that the head is where we live, divine sphere that the gods created, and the body he describes as a vehicle. He says, well, you know, the gods made this divine sphere, the head, and realized it needed a vehicle or else it would get stuck in ditches and, you know, couldn't travel over the hills and dales of the world. So the body, the gods grew this convenient vehicle so the head could get around. That's the primary story by which we live today, and we consider it normal. We consider it even inevitable that we should live in our heads, and we know of no other way of being. And to live in the head is to be married to the values of the head, which are male values. In fact, you know, capitalism. The word capital comes from a Latin word meaning head. Capitalism is headism. It's completely married to male values of control and systemization and hierarchies and the breaking of the world into its bits in order to understand them and control them. And that is what is killing us. So in its essence, what is killing us on a social scale, but also as individuals, is how we live in the body. If there's one thing that I would like a reader to walk away from the book with, it would be the ability to drop down through the body and discover what is in effect our second brain. This isn't just a metaphor. Physiologically, we have two brains. The resistance our culture has put up to the acknowledgement of that is a whole story in itself that shows how devoted our culture is to male values, because it was this second brain lives in the belly. It was discovered by Byron Robinson in the 1800s and forgotten. Johannes Langley discovered it in the 1920s. It was forgotten. Michael Gerson rediscovered it independently in the 1960s and had to do research and present papers and reams of evidence before, you know, it was in the 1980s that neuroscience finally capitulated and said, okay, by any definition of a brain, we have to say that what resides in the gut, that dense neurological mass that is thoroughly intertwined with our guts and our digestive organs, but it is an independent, remembering, processing, perceiving intelligence. And that is, you know, the whole universe the creative potency of the universe is something that happens when complementary opposites unite. So the very potency of our humanity and our human genius is found in a reconciliation of the female pole of our intelligence, which resides in the belly, and what I refer to it as the pelvic intelligence, and the head. It's not a matter of you know, dissing the male values and saying we have to get away from them, because they're as indispensable as are the female values. But we have locked ourselves into this unipolar intelligence that is stuck in the head, and the fullest potential of our humanity is found in an exchange between the intelligence in the head and the intelligence in the pelvis. And to return to the intelligence in the pelvis is to return to being. The pelvic intelligence is where we can consciously be. The intelligence in the head, the cranial intelligence, is where we can consciously think. We need both of those things. But at this point, we have dissociated our thinking from our being. And we believe, and this goes back again to the Greeks, we believe that by cutting ourselves off from being, we can reason more clearly and move ourselves closer to the truth and to the solutions that are best. But the more you cut yourself off from being, the more you cut yourself off from the world and its subtly informed intelligence, and you basically isolate yourself in the head. You distance yourself from all the body's sensations, and the effect of isolation on the human psyche is always hallucination. If you put someone in an isolation chamber and you isolate them, you know, as these things do, from what is heard and what is felt and what is seen, they go mad. They, you know, it doesn't take that long before they're hearing things and hallucinating and lose entirely their sense of self, because the self doesn't exist independent of the world. The self is sustained by every mote of the universe, and, you know, quantum physics has amply demonstrated that. So that's what I, long-winded answer, but that's really what I would like the reader to come away with, this sense of new possibility in terms of inhabiting the body and uniting with its intelligence.
And you have such an eloquent way of putting that. And even in your book, I actually teach a course, and I've been teaching it for probably about the past 5 or 6 years. And it's a three-part course, but the first part, which I always feel is so important, is called the incarnate level. And it's about teaching people how to get in their bodies and really understanding all that means. And it's really pretty detailed, but I find that most people want to skip that and go to what the second step, which is transformation. They want to start transforming it. And it's so interesting how I have to explain, because people just, it's almost like they're afraid to get back in there and reconnect. And to me, that's the foundation of really bringing any type of unity consciousness into existence, not only within our own world and within our own selves, but in uniting with other people and creating that throughout the planet. And when I was reading your book, you know, as I was going through your book, I started taking so many notes, because I'm like, oh, this will be so good for my class. And then I realized that I was, like, noting everything. I thought, I'm going to have to read this book through and then go back through and make notes and then go back through and whittle them down. Because you've basically taken that, everything that I've been teaching, and you've got all the documentation and you've got all references and you've got a lot of really good information that, for me personally in my coursework in teaching that, I'm like, gosh, I wish this man had written this book 5 years ago. It would have made my life a lot easier. Because you put into a book what I'm trying to walk people through. And do you find when you're talking with people that people are just, to me, they just don't want to get in there. They want to kind of keep in that mainstream. They want things to be different, but they don't want anything to change. They don't want to do any change. And without being in that body, without being fully in there and engaged with that gut brain center. It's very challenging to do because the mind or the brain in our head keeps running the programs.
Well, I couldn't agree more. The brain in the head sets up basically a duplicate of the world. So it has an idea or a system of ideas that represent the world, and these ideas stand independent of the world itself. So they're static. They don't change. Even though the world around us is ceaselessly transforming, these ideas remain immune to that, and they represent the status quo. And we have a system of ideas that represents the self, which in the book I call the known self. We have a system of ideas that allows us to look at a teacup and see the idea of it without fully connecting with it. And that's just endemic to our way of inhabiting the brain. You cannot consciously be if you're in the head, just as you don't consciously think when you're united with the pelvic intelligence. And transformation, my goodness, you know, my heart breaks a little bit at the way in which our culture is awakening to the absolute terror of our ways, to the toll it takes on the world around us. I live in Canada, and I don't know of a stream that I could go to within 200 miles of where I live and drink gladly from it and know that it was life-giving water. But, you know, 200 years ago, you could go to almost any stream and do that. What have we done? And so we're awakening to that. But what causes me grief is that we think the solution to these problems lies in a technological trick that will save us. And the reason we devote ourselves to that belief is because what we want the technological trick to save us from is having to transform who we are and who we know ourselves to be. We want to stay just the same. We want the status quo preserved, and yeah, let's fix the world. How can we do that? And the modes that we rely on for doing that are ones that are purely devoted to the values and the systems and the means that are delivered by abstract thought. I understand that, but it's the way we live in the body that makes us disinclined to understand that thought itself affects the world. It's just been amply demonstrated from the Human Consciousness Project, in which random event generators that run all over the world are correlated by a computer that maps it out, and it usually flatlines. But then they noticed, oh, there was a huge spike that happened to correspond with Princess Diana's funeral, and another huge spike that happened to correspond with the Twin Towers. I talk in my book. I have an appendix in New Self, New World that goes through the double slit experiment, which shows that our ability to perceive a photon, to follow its path, to assign causality to it, will change the photon from one that exhibits wave-like behavior to one that exhibits particulate behavior. So it behaves like a book. So our thoughts are so intimately part of the world we create. And this is something that we would rather not believe, because it places a huge responsibility on us. Suddenly, even what you think matters. And as long as you're stuck in the head, that's a terrifying prospect. Once you drop down into the wholeness of your full intelligence, you realize you don't think in isolation. We have this idea that the brain creates and is the sole source of our consciousness, the way the music in the cars we drive is just heard within the car, and it's created by the little iPod or the tape deck in the car, and that we get this chatter that goes through our heads because the chatter is driven because it's in isolation from the world around it. It can't come into relationship with our full sensational being. But when you realize that there is a universal law that says everything is in relationship. An electron at the remotest edge of the cosmos affects weather patterns on the Earth. And I don't mean this metaphorically. There's a book that a professor out of Princeton wrote where he actually cites, it's called Chance and Chaos, and it actually cites the calculations that show if you were to suspend the gravitational field of a single electron at the remotest fringe of the cosmos, and then you were back on Earth and you were able to watch molecules in the air in a room, you'd follow one molecule and it would, you know, go through about 50 collisions the way it would have anyway, and then suddenly it would miss a molecule that it would otherwise have hit, and thereafter all the reactions that take place in that room would be different. Not only that, the next day, if there was some turbulence in the weather, if you were outside, you'd feel gusts of air that wouldn't have been there had that gravitational field, which is a very weak force of a single electron, which is an impossibly minute bit of mass at the remotest fringe of the galaxy, had been intact. And you'd see clouds that would be different. So the substructure of interrelationship that upholds the entire universe is subtle beyond our imagining, and yet we believe that our thinking is held independently of the world and just goes ahead and processes its ideas. And I address this in New Self, New World, and I say, no, our thinking isn't a phenomenon that happens independent of the world. It happens in partnership with the world. And once you begin to recognize the world as your partner in thinking, then you open the door to transformation. Then you open the door to newness. And that's basically the title of the book, New Self, New World, really hints at the fact that once you've liberated the self from its cultural prison, as I think of it, then you open your eyes onto a world that is utterly transformed. And that transformation, as you said, is one that cannot take effect until the deepest normal to which we've habituated has transformed, and that is how we relate to the body.
Right. Now, I want to take an opportunity to mention that you all, anybody that's listening, can go to Philip's website, which is philipshepherd.com, and it's philipshepherd.com. You can also go to The Honoring Hour, www.thehonoringhour.com. Today it's on our guest page. In the very near future, it will be on our archives page. There's a link if you're having trouble finding it or spelling it correctly. Again, it's philipshepherd.com. And you can check some of the information, and you can also order his book. Now, Philip, can they order your book from the website? What's the easiest way for them to get your book?
No, the book is distributed by Random House, so it's available at Amazon and Barnes & Noble and Borders and hopefully at your local bookshop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Yeah, so you can go into your local bookshop. It's widely publicized. It's out there in the mainstream. So start asking your bookstore to stock it, your favorite bookstore to stock it in there so other people can pick it up as they're browsing through. Now, I wanted to ask you, because you were touching on one of my, my pet peeves, my passions, my soapboxes, and that is, with people abdicating responsibility. They want authority, but no, they don't necessarily want to take responsibility. And one of the things that I really like about your book is in each chapter, you actually offer at the end of the chapter, or, most chapters, you offer some steps that people can take that really helps them very gently, in my language, not necessarily yours, get into their body so that they can start making this shift from their head and that unithinking and uni way of living into a more blended, more harmonious decision-making existence. Can you address that a little bit? Do you find that, that when you were writing this book, did you find that that was one of the things you were seeing is, people go along with, oh, well, that's just the way it is. There's all kinds of catchphrases. That's the way it is. That's my luck. There's nothing I can do about it. They just, toss that sense of responsibility off. Or they're taking on some that's not their own, so they can't even take care of stuff that's theirs.
Absolutely true. In fact, I go into detail in the book about the ways, because we have divided ourselves into mind and body, we live in a constant state of self-tyranny. And, there's so much language, even in the New Age, about mastering the self. And, it's possible to go down that road, but every time you gain some ground on mastering the self, you're also gaining some ground on putting the self into slavery, because the part of you that is doing the ordering makes of a slave a mute, insensate slave, the part of you that is being ordered. And because we have habituated to this state of self-tyranny, and if you live in the head, you may not immediately recognize it, but you are living in a state of self-tyranny to the extent that you are living according to a set of ideas that by which you command yourself and direct yourself and admonish yourself and judge yourself and judge others. And because we have so habituated to that inner authority that runs our female being, we are sitting ducks when it comes to other authorities. In fact, in New Self, New World, I talk about lab coat voodoo, the effect that experts have on us. And I tell a story. I once broke my ankle, and I didn't know it was broken, and I thought maybe I'd sprained it or whatever. And so I was doing contracting work at the time, and carried on for about a week, and it didn't get better. So I hopped on my bicycle and rode to the hospital, and the doctor said, "Oh, we better X-ray it." And he came out after the X-rays, and he looked at me and he said, "Well, your ankle's broken." And I thought he was joking. He said, "No, it's broken." So I was standing there talking to the doctor, and suddenly, upon hearing those words, "Your ankle is broken," I could not walk. It was like the effect of voodoo. And I realized how ridiculous that was. I've been walking all week, and I regained my ability to get around, but it made me appreciate the incantations that are put upon us whereby we disconnect from our being and what we know to be true, and its guidance, and defer to an authority. So we are so used to looking for expertise and often accepting it in disregard of our own genius for being present. And that's very closely coupled with the responsibility. If you look at the word responsibility, it comes, the essence of the word lies in the word response. So to live in the head is to have chosen, even by default, a way of being that is unresponsive to the world. In other words, you've withdrawn from the sensations of the body, and you are, in effect, a little isolation chamber that makes you not immune to, but certainly much less responsive to the genius of the present, the sensational, mindful present that contains the memory of all things past, the potential for all things to flower in the future. It is attuned to that electron at the furthermost fringe of the cosmos. And to disconnect from the present in that way is to put yourself in a state of, in effect, irresponsibility. On the other hand, to drop in to the body and join the present, upon responding to the present, and I don't just mean the present in its particulars, I'm talking about the ability to feel the present as a whole. And the ability to feel anything as a whole is something we've unknowingly sacrificed in our migration from the pelvic intelligence to the head. The head specializes in breaking things into pieces and systemizing and understanding them and seeing their relationships, but it is incapable. I mean, we're incapable of objectively knowing anything as a whole. There is just too much. There is too much to know. We can't possibly compass all there is to know about an electron, let alone the present. But we can feel the present, and that, you know, there's a Latin word. The Latin word that's at the basis of our word sensation is sentire, and it means both to think and to feel. So there's a recognition that feeling itself is a sort of sensation, is a sort of thinking. And ultimately, if you think about what intelligence is, we're so used to thinking of intelligence as the faculty in our brain that is capable of abstract reasoning that we completely diminish its full dimension, because intelligence is just sensitivity. So sure, there's a sensitivity to arithmetic relationship. There's a sensitivity to architectural harmony. There's a sensitivity to a child's tears. There's a sensitivity to the movements of clouds in the skies. It's all sensitivity. To live in your head is to deprive yourself of most of your own sensitivity. And you rely, by living in the head, on knowledge that is in pieces, that can never add up to a whole. And, you know, science itself always promises a complete understanding of the world, but it's not possible. It will never get there. That's not how wholeness is achieved. But to feel the present as a whole is entirely within our capabilities as human beings. And when you come into relationship with that sensational present, you're coming into an I-thou relationship, which is really where our ancestors started. They felt the world to be a living entity, and they were in relationship with it and found guidance there. And as soon as you feel that, as soon as you get to the point of sensitivity where you can feel the thou of the present and just say, guide me, you have come to a place of responsibility, because the world will call to you. The world needs your service. It needs your intelligence. It needs your willingness to do good, to make a contribution, and it will call to your particular gifts. And in responding to that call, you discover responsibility.
Right. I couldn't agree more. And that's one thing that I, you know, stress that this show is really about, is rising to that true inner calling, irregardless of the pressures, the external pressures of trying to keep you in the mainstream. And I think that, you know, again, you know, the way that you speak, it's absolutely beautiful. It's eloquent, very well spoken. You know, you're like having magic in the air in how you present it.
That's so lovely. Thank you, Lynn.
I'm really glad that you were bringing up the information about senses and because that really brought me when you I think you introduced that stuff in the third somewhere early on in the book, like in the third chapter.
Mm-hmm.
Because I remember writing early on, there was something about it when you said, and I've got written down here, where you wrote, when we're out of touch with the brain and our guts, we tend to store stress there without even being aware of it. Somewhere on that same page, and I've got noted down here in my scribble, I think it's page 70 in your book, so if I'm wrong about that to our listeners, I'm sorry, but it's probably close. I was writing pretty fast. The next association that I made on that page was that disease is associated with an impairment in the flow of the body's energy. So then I made a note based on some other stuff that you were writing. Just my own personal thinking went to dumbing down of society through poor food practices. So somewhere in there you must have been talking about something that was reminding me of food and how we're feeding the body and we're really getting ourselves even further removed from that gut-brain sense. And it's breaking down. And certainly in America, I can't, you know, I'm not well-traveled, so I can't necessarily speak to other countries. But in America, we are really breaking down physically. You know, we're a fast food society. I can't even call it food. I'm calling it feud. Is that a Freudian slip or what? So we're just breaking ourselves down, and we're getting further and further removed from our sense of truth and who we really are. And again, you know, you state this in here. So are you, you know, when you're writing this, when you were writing this, do you see, because you are so much more well-traveled than I am, are you seeing that in cultures that are a little bit more laid back, that have less stress, that they're more in tune with the foods that they're putting in their body and the world around them? How do you have any thoughts on that, or did I just go somewhere that you don't have an interest and didn't really look at?
Oh, I actually have an interest in almost everything. But no, you're absolutely right. In the book, I talk about, you know, early on, I say, you know, food to us represents a commodity to which our bank balance entitles us. And I contrast that with the Maori tradition in which food is sacred. There are things you're not allowed to do with food. You can't play with your food. It's like playing with God's gift. But I think our problem with food, if I may say so, and you know, Canada isn't that far behind the United States. I'll go out on a limb here. Why not? The United States is one of the countries that, in certain ways, has most ardently devoted itself to male values. So your resistance to health care is an expression of a male value of independence, which has truth and falsity. I mean, in effect, as we know, the universal law of the universe is interrelationship, so there really is no independence. There really is no isolated me. But the male element, when it pulls away from the female element, and all of us are born with a male element and a female element as aspects of our psyche, when the male element pulls away from the female element, it pulls away from being itself. It believes that it's independent because it can feel itself isolated in the cranium. And because America has so devoted itself in so many ways to capitalism and to male values across the realm, and considers those values to be an entitlement to which they're born, the male element has really disconnected from the female element of being. Now, as soon as you disconnect from being, you are left with an uncertain sense of your own being. And that generates fear at every level of society. So I know for some Americans, the thought of falling asleep without a gun beside the bed is as unimaginable to them as to any of my friends who would find it unimaginable to fall asleep with a gun beside their bed. But that fear that is rooted in an uncertain sense of being is something that promotes addiction, because you have a sense of lack and you want to fill it, and that deepest sense of lack is the disconnection from your own being. But that is the normal to which you've devoted yourself, and so you seek to fill that lack in other ways. And food, of course, is just one of the ways in which that manifests. But it's a way that is so so deeply promoted by the interests that want you to buy their food and want you to think that it is food. It's remarkable. When, you know, I was in Italy not that long ago, driving down the highway, and you know, you get hungry, so you pull off at one of those stops on the highway that sell you gas and sell you food. You walk into this place, and is it a McDonald's or a Burger King? No, it's fresh vegetables and a selection of cheeses, and you go along with a plate and you serve yourself to this real food and put it on your plate, whatever you'd like to eat, and you know, that you take it to the cashier and she weighs it or whatever and says you owe this much money, and what they make available, and it's on a real plate. It's not on china, not styrofoam, and it's just an entirely different way, and it may be true that there's not quite the economic leverage in doing it that way, but that more than anything shows the impoverishment of this attachment to the male values that we have, where the bottom line for us is economy. The bottom line is the money, and what happens when our male element pulls away or withdraws from the female element and isolates itself, is that it not only becomes the tyrant that I spoke of earlier, but it takes on all the characteristics of tyranny. And one of the foremost characteristics of a tyrant is the urge to acquire. And of course, that's another given of our North American society that's hard to call into question, because we were so out of our bodies. When you're deeply in your body, deeply in the present, nothing. There is no sense of lack. There's just a sense of abundance and companionship.
I think that's so true. I actually have an example of that. I'm in the human service work field, and I've been working a case that's really can be pretty stressful. So, and my daughter, I was sharing with you earlier before the show started that my daughter's life is just really taking off. So I've been extremely busy, but I've done a really good job of staying mainstream and doing what I love to do, or not mainstream, and I don't consider mainstream anymore what other people want me to do. I consider my mainstream is what I love and what feeds me and fuels me.
Perfect.
So, right. So what happened was I had a situation in this case where it was a crisis situation. I responded. I stayed nice and calm through it. I never got agitated. And then about 2 days later, I had to go and review it because something about the case was going to go to court. So I spent an insane amount of time, because I got up and out of my body and into my head, going back into memory and documenting and stuff. And it's just it has thrown me for the past couple of days. I have been really uncentered. And I, you know, I'm happy to say, and I knock on wood, I had forgotten how horrible that sense and that feeling was when you come up and out and you stop engaging. And just it really did feel like I started to feel overwhelmed. And so when my daughter was speaking to me or any of my family members were speaking to me, like I wasn't able to just, it was overwhelmed. I couldn't handle it. If it wasn't important, I was like, I can't do this. And finally, it, like something just struck me. It's like, wait a second, I never really got back in. After I got out, I never took the time to get back in, and that's why I was feeling depleted and tired, and, you know, so I had to really get back in there. And I'm thankful that, you know, that it was only, it was like a day and a half that I was kind of like discombobulated, and then it carries on, and I'll have to regenerate. But, you know, to think that I used to go for months or even years on end, and to even think that there's people out there that walk around in that state constantly. You know, I send out, you know, my own, for my own energy, I draw that in, and I really ask that that embodiment and that sense of peace and tranquility and that lack of anxiousness just be able to, you know, radiate into, you know, to the space around me, and that other people could pick it up and utilize it as they, you know, in their own lives as they see fit. Because it does, it really did let me, like the whole world just seemed to spiral out of control, and I did feel like I was being controlled again, and it did feel like I was, you know, that whole tyrant, the world is, you know, a rough place, and it just was like, woo, cascading in.
Yeah, there's a principle in New Self, New World: as we relate to the body, so we relate to the world. So it's an interesting clue, because, you know, if the world around you looks chaotic and divisive and antagonistic, that suggests that that's coming out of your relationship to your own body. And I've got a parallel story to yours in a funny way. I, as an actor, I studied The Voice, and the teacher I studied with taught me how to breathe with the sacrum, which is that triangular bone at the base of the spine. When he first suggested that I could breathe with the sacrum, I had no idea what he was talking about. And slowly I became aware, but it seemed an impossibility at the time. And then, you know, eventually I learned how to breathe with the sacrum, and it felt so much easier. And now it's my normal state. And when I'm not allowing the breath to drop that fully into my body, it feels bad. And so I say, oh, right, let the breath drop in. And so it just feels better. And so I do it consistently and am alerted to a lack of that whole body breath. And that, again, that's why in the book, as you said, I end each chapter with an exercise, because to come to an intellectual understanding of the challenges we face both as individuals and society at large helps, but there can be no transformation without a change in the status quo of how we live in the body. And so the exercise at the end of each chapter is really designed, and I like your word, gentle. They are gentle exercises that open doors, I'm hoping, for readers to the universe that is their sensational body. And, you know, you drop down into the body, and you do it when you've been absent for years, and you encounter darkness and chaos and disarray, but stay with it, and stay with it patiently, and stay with it with love, and ultimately you find a place of such harmony to the extent that the body itself holds within it the mindful present. So there really is a sense that the mindful present comes to rest within the pelvic bowl. And then there can be no isolation, there can be no alienation, there can be no division, because you're in such a place of wholeness.
That's beautifully put. I absolutely love that. I just want to remind everybody that's listening, because we are starting to get to the end of the show, you can get Philip's book basically anywhere. If it's not in your local bookstore, ask them to order it. It's New Self, New World, Recovering Our Senses in the 21st Century. Philip's website is philipshepherd.com. It's philipshepherd.com. And Philip, are you doing any book signings and book tours? Do you have anything like that coming up where people might be able to come and meet you?
Yeah, I haven't got a tour lined up, but what is starting to happen, which excites me even more, is people are starting to ask for workshops. Because I've taught all my life, and I just love it with such a passion. And so, you know, someone from Tulsa, Oklahoma, contacted me and said, love your book, could you teach a workshop? So that's starting to happen. Someone from California asked for it. So that's, you know, that's where I'm hoping this will take me, because I know how much I've been helped by the guidance of others, and it brings me so much joy to help someone in a very gentle way transform and discover themselves anew. So hopefully more of that will begin to happen as well.
Wonderful. So if somebody listening wants to get in touch with you because they're interested in organizing a workshop or even finding out about some that you have upcoming, is the best way for them to reach you through the website, or do you have a number that they would call?
The website would be an easy way. I've also, the book has a Facebook page. It's just called New Self, New World, Philip Shepherd. So there's it's a fan page, but the website I think has a place where it's very easy to contact me by email.
Right.
And if you buy a copy of the book, my email address is also at the back of it under the author's bio. So the email address is simple enough. It's just philip@philipshepherd.com.
Right. And I have to say, I love most of the people I've had on the show that have written a book. They make it very easy to get in touch with them. It's not these aren't abstract people out there. You know, and you're live and you're here and you're accessible on Facebook and you know your website. It's nice to be able to connect with the people that have got the information out there. And I know just from you know having the book in my hand and reading it and. You know, like I said, I went through it making notes and, you know, I'll have to read it again, you know, just so that I can, you know, both absorb it and finish taking the notes that I wanted, that I initially started taking. I absolutely love it. I think that a workshop, you know, based on this information is just, you know, it's such a gift to the world. So thank you so very much for putting that out there for people.
Oh, yeah, it's as I said, it's just such a profound joy to take. And it's funny because the book grew out of workshops that I taught over many years. And now the workshops themselves stand on this foundation of the book, and that's very exciting for me.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, Philip, I want to thank you for joining me today, for being on here, and I'm definitely going to be sending Jeff Brown a big thank you again for, you know, connecting.
Yeah, I'm so glad he did. He's just such a gracious soul. He truly is.
Right. He definitely is. So for anybody out there listening, just to wrap it up and let you know, it's New Self, New World by Philip Shepherd. You can get it at your local bookstore. You can go to his website, philipshepherd.com, and he's inviting people for workshops. So if you're in an area where you'd like to get a group together and invite him, sounds like he's definitely welcome.
Absolutely.
Philip, again, thank you so much for being here, you know, for joining us today. This was absolutely a gift to have you on the show.
It's been such a pleasure to talk to you about it all. Thank you so much for that.
Wonderful. So thank you, listeners. I want to remind you that you can go to www.thehonoringhour.com to keep up with what we're doing. We are on Facebook. Our link is on our main page of the Facebook. We're on LinkedIn. I have to say that's new to me. I'm learning how to do it. And we Twitter automatically thanks to the wonderful technology of Blog Talk, because I'm not Twitter savvy yet either. But please do join us on each of those sites. I welcome anybody that has information that they want me to pursue. I like to broaden my So please do offer any suggestions. My email link is at the end, at the bottom of the main page. Thanks again for joining us, and we look forward to next time. Enjoy your day.